You're talking about the war. And I was wondering about, did you ever worry about being bombed, being on the...
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. When the Japanese, a bomb or torpedo or something came in towards Santa Barbara, yes, we worried quite a bit. And, of course, we had the camouflage over the plant and over our sitting area. And, yes, it was very, very close all the time. I had a brother that was in the Seabees, and he was stationed, I'm sorry.
Okay. I haven't been my house,
He was stationed part of the time at Wainimi, Port Wainimi. And I would, that was the closest frightening time. I would cross where the bomb or torpedo hit in the beach area, going up to see him. And that was a little too close for comfort. Plus, about a mile and a half, I guess, from Northrop on Prairie Avenue and, was it Imperial? Yeah, Imperial and Prairie. There was a Japanese open-air vegetable market. And they found, I don't know how many weapons there, and they were sympathizing with Japan. And that kind of shook us up because we all went there to buy vegetables. And to realize that anyone could live in this country and be faithful to another country, you know, if you're born here, you can't understand that, or at least I couldn't. And, yes, we had a few frightening times.
So, when rationing and all that kind of stuff, gas rationing, did rationing affect you in other ways?
Oh, yes, sugar and coffee and cigarettes, and I didn't smoke, but most of the people I knew did. And it was meat rationing, and of course gas rationing. I didn't have any problem with gas rationing because I was allowed an A sticker and a C sticker. A is everyone got so many gallons. And I drove 9 miles to work and had two quote-unquote carpoolers. Didn't really ride with me too much. And a couple of fellows in the plant, father figures in the jig shop, didn't use all of their A's, and they would give them to me and others that needed gas. So I managed to drive about 20,000 miles a year during gas rest. Oh, I had a ball. It was fun. You know, it really wasn't. We speak of hard times and you hear of rationing in other countries, but rationing, as long as it was fair, and it was fair, and rent control and things that we had was fair and was controlled. So it never bothered me because I didn't do without anything that I didn't feel that I could have given up 10 times more if it would have ended the war. Because the Sunday morning that Pearl Harbor was bombed, I felt that the whole world had come to an end. Because I just could not imagine why Japan would attack us when we had been selling them all of our scrap metals and everything all those years. And I guess I wasn't that mature, come to think about it, to think that war was a possibility, although Roosevelt had talked about it and the dangers of not being prepared for a number of years. But having come out of the Depression and not really fully understanding the financial happenstance to wars. They're not against people. It's financial. And that's a rude awakening also. It's hard to understand wars. I don't think we'll ever have another war like that one.
How did you feel about the Japanese internment? when that happened, the Japanese-American internment. Do you remember that happened?
I felt it was grossly unfair.
Mm-hmm. At the time, mm-hmm. Anything that went mm-hmm. to?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So even though this thing had happened with the vegetable stand?
Well, there again, I'm an unusual earth person. It just hit me as grossly unfair that families that had been born in this country, mm-hmm. I could not understand their sympathy to Japan, mm-hmm. And the confiscation of their property. I could not go along with that in this country. Mm-hmm. Maybe there was one gnat's eyebrow of patriotism to Japan, mm-hmm. of the thousands that lost all of their property up in Marin County and up in around Fresno and up in there. Mm-hmm. The children are still fighting to get back their land that the politicians got. That I just cannot accept in this country. Mm-hmm. But the internment, they fared food-wise better than we did. Mm-hmm. They were not rationed. They were treated right. They were fed properly. And they did have to be, I accepted their move, for the majority of them, mm-hmm. back away from the coast. Mm-hmm. But I could not see why their property had to be confiscated.
Mm-hmm. When you were working in that, Jake Shaver and Northrop in, mm-hmm. in general, were there maybe non-white workers?
No blacks,
mm-hmm.
some Mexicans, some of different nationalities,
mm-hmm.
but no blacks.
Mm-hmm. Did that seem to be an intentional exclusion, or was that?
Lack of qualifications,
mm-hmm.
only,
mm-hmm.
that's all.
Mm-hmm. So if someone had applied there and been
qualified mm-hmm.
uh-huh.
they would have been hired.
Uh-huh. And with the Hispanic workers, were any of those people?
Some,
no.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Did you know anyone, say, in the jig department who was some Mexican-American? Or?
Yes, we had Indians. We had some Mexicans.
Mm-hmm.
And I never got the feeling later on there was Japanese
mm-hmm.
in the plant.
Mm-hmm.
But as you grow and mature in your own life,
mm-hmm.
you see the inequity in different nationalities.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see any objection to blacks, Hispanics, any other nationality in the workforce
mm-hmm.
or the employee amount of them.
Mm-hmm.
I was working there when we hired the first blacks.
Mm-hmm.
Government demand.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to be qualified. They don't have to be today.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not right.
At the time, though, did it seem that were the Mexican workers also part of this family situation? Or did
Certainly.
They Mm-hmm. So there didn't seem to be any different treatment.
And the blacks who have come in have joined the family just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm. But that happened after the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, as the war began to wind down,
mm-hmm.
Well, first let me ask you, you said you'd begun up to the B classification.
Mm-hmm.
And did you work on pretty much the same machine the whole time?
The whole time.
You were
mm-hmm.
there?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then and would get they had a regular sort of increase that went along
mm-hmm.
with that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Merit raises, they call them.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
But you stayed at the...
Mm-hmm.
Did any of the women ever get an A?
Not in the jig shop. Not under Pappy Dills.
Uh-huh.
He was there until he retired in the jig shop.
Mm-hmm. When you had gone to work there, did you think of that as a job that you would have beyond the war?
No, I never thought about it.
Uh-huh. One way or the other?
No.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew I had to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was that your first job ever?
I take it back. I worked one day as a salesman at a liquor store across the way from where I lived on 42nd Street. And this was while I was still married, before I went to San Francisco. And there was a lot of winos on Vermont, and the liquor store was on Vermont. And the fella assured me, the boss, that nobody would just grab a bottle and run to put it on the counter in a sack and then take their money. Well, a wino came in one day and grabbed the bottle and ran. And he read me off for it, so I quit. And I worked a half a day at a dime store on Vermont also. And there was $5 missing in the till. How it happened, I don't know. But there was six of we employees, and each one was accused of taking and they tried to make us make it up. And I quit because I didn't do it, and I wasn't going to be tainted with it. So I quit. And that's the only two jobs I ever had.
So about a day and a half altogether?
Day and a half. And that went on my application at Northrop.
Had you just decided about that time to try and get a job, or when you got these two short?
Bored. There was nothing to do, and my husband didn't make very much money because he was working as a filling station attendant, and I think he made about, maybe $20 a week, and we were just living hand to mouth, just not getting anywhere. Well, I always had ambitions of doing something with your life, not just, whatever. And then when the war broke out, he went to San Francisco, to the Richmond shipyards, to be a chipper. And he went from 20-some-odd dollars a week to 300-and-something a week. That was the difference in the pay scale.
Wow. And so so he had worked in the shipyards there for a while before getting drafted.
Yeah.
That's right. So how did it feel to be having your own paycheck? Do you remember how that felt?
Felt very good to know that I had earned, actually capable of earning it. Not in a field that I had wanted to choose when I came to California, because I wanted to work in the design industry. Of course, I wasn't qualified, but you can dream. I've always been fond of anything to do with your hands, sewing or anything like that. But I came from a do-it-yourself family and mechanically inclined. You learn to do things. In those days, it was survival. Everybody learned.
So when you, as time went on and you were just sort of, say by the time when you really sort of were thinking of yourself as a defense worker or whatever, how did you feel about your job and the...
I just hoped and prayed every day it would last after the war. Hoped I could find a place. And then when the war ended, and they took, well, of course, as soon as the war ended, Pappy Dill sent Florence and I to Crenshaw. And I'd love to know why he kept me on, because I was a thorn in his side, and the orneriest white woman he ever met is the way he described me in later years. When... so many were going, just going out the door. They got their pink slips. There was no jobs. And, of course, there was no call for defense planes in those days. So we were building the flying wing, or it started on that. And, of course, that was a dream of Mr. Northrop's. And I have a fabulous scrapbook that was some executives in Northrop that sent it to me through Tom after I left Northrop. He just knew that I would love it because I had worked on the jigs for the wing and all the way through to cutting it up with blowtorches. And...
was this a certain type of plane?
Only a wing. Just a wing. And it was... well, it would be new today. And that was back in 1945 and 46 that we were building those. And it was a political Simonson wanted General Dynamics to be the only aircraft factory in the United States. And he cut J.K. Northrop's throat and not only killed the contract for the wing, mm-hmm. which was a better plane in every aspect than the B-36 that took its place. Or B-52, I forgot. Gad. Anyway, he forced Northrop to cut up the last 13 planes. They couldn't even finish. Well, two of them was on, one was out on the flight field ready to fly to the Air Force, and another one was ready for final inspection, and the rest were on down. He made them cut them up with blowtorches and haul them away. And Mr. Northrop finally told that story not 6 months before he died. This year it came out of what happened. And he kept quiet for fear that they would close his doors. And you see, we're non-union, so we have lost more contracts for better planes than any other company in the United States, politically. Northrop built 3,000 planes on time, on budget, and no other company has ever done that. And they continually try to cut our throats. They have planes stacked up on fields they can't get parts for to keep companies open. That can't cut the mustard or won't cut the mustard, kickbacks, and it's just criminal. But that's politics. The unions feed the politics.
Now, when the, say when there had been, say, what is it, VE Day, before VJ Day, and that time, and did people have a sense that maybe the war would be ending since they had victory in Europe?
We had more fears. Because, well, they called European theater the civilized theater. Japan was uncivilized. The Japanese had, I don't know how much of the war era you've studied, but they had dug in and had holes in the ground and lived like animals in islands and all around their bunkers and everything, and they had, well, they were dedicated to life. It was an honor to die for Japan. And how can you fight that, you know? And their prison camps were a lot like Oswald, and, you know. So it was not a civilized war, and people feared, you know, their sons being shipped to the seas for that reason, because it was an uncivilized war and it was a no-win situation. And that's why we had to use the atomic bomb. It was expedient. It was horrendous, and I don't know if this country will ever survive the Holocaust that it caused the world, because we've been the only one to ever drop the bomb.
Did you, at the working at the plant, did people feel like, despite, I mean, they had their personal fears for, I mean, for the people that were still fighting, did they begin to think about where they would work if the war came to an end, or did anyone start talking about that, or did that still seem like it might be a long way off?
Oh, yes, a lot of women that I heard talk mainly, and some men. Well, they hoped the war would last forever. They'd never made so much money in their life. And one woman who had lost a son almost killed a woman for making that statement in the restroom. You know, I mean, you can see both sides. She'd never, she had not, the woman that made the statement had not thought before she engaged her mouth. But, oh, yes, there was a lot of, well, to me, servicemen were the gods, because I was that patriotic. And a man who would openly say, well, I came in to escape the draft, you know. Well, he was just dirt. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to associate with one. And I almost hit a fellow after I became a clerk because his remark was that, just wait a little bit and you can get a house cheap from a vet. Let him be the fall guy. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I hate that guy's guts. Mm-hmm. How dare anybody take advantage of a veteran who has fought for this country? Mm-hmm. And he was a little weasel that he escaped. But that's my own bigotry, I guess. Mm-hmm. Or morality, or whatever you want to call it.
So,
yeah, a lot of them worried. Women in particular, because there was... they thought that the war, when it was over, we'd all be out the door. That's what I fully expected. Mm-hmm. But Florence wanted to be laid off because she could, it wasn't unemployment, what was it she could get if she was laid off? And if you quit, you couldn't get it. It must have been unemployment because her husband was coming home and she wanted to be laid off. But... since we'd come in the plant together, I feel that's why Pappy Dills sent her down to Crenshaw, because all of the women left the jig shop, mm-hmm. and we were sent to Crenshaw.
Now, did this happen immediately? Well, do you remember the day the war ended?
In August 45, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Well, that's when I was sent to Crenshaw.
Uh-huh. So it was like that same day?
Or? Well, the next day. Uh-huh. We all were mustered out or laid off or transferred. And Florence.
So it was the very next day.
Yeah, the very next day, yes. There was no interim. Mm-hmm. Florence and I were sent down to Crenshaw, and Mosby Masters was general foreman in the machine shop, and that was production machine shop.
Mm-hmm.
That
Crenshaw is a
division of Northrop, uh-huh. Northrop Crenshaw. There was Plant 1, Plant 2, and Plant 3, which was Crenshaw. Mm-hmm. There was a machine shop in Plant 1 and in Plant 3. And we were sent down to the machine shop in Plant 3. Well, Mosby Masters was the general foreman, and he let us sit on our behinds for 8 hours. He didn't want any more bawling women. He'd had women, and we were just left sitting in another area. And finally, our timekeeper, luckily for jig shop timekeeper, came around and asked us what we were doing, and we said we were waiting to be put to work. And he went over and talked to Mose, and he said, and Mose said he didn't want any more bawling women, and he says, fine, I'll just put them on idle time. Well, he had to account for all of his time. So he put us to sweeping the floor, sorting nuts, any insulting job to make us quit. Mm-hmm. Well, Florence worked 2 weeks, and then she asked Mose, and Mose laid her off. And I needed the job, so I would do anything he told me and say thank you. I wasn't going to create any waves because I had nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. And certainly my training there wouldn't fit me for anything else. So I say anything else. I could have gone to a factory of various kinds, I imagine, on the east side, but I didn't want to go. I was too frightened to go. And so finally he put me on running parts when he decided I wasn't going to quit. So then that went on until October 1st, and that's when they took all women in the labor force off at night. The government ruling stopped. Mm-hmm. Whatever it was, I don't remember, other than they took us all off the machines. Mm-hmm. So I was going to be laid off. And they needed a clerk, department clerk, to keep records on all of the men. And by that time, Mose had been broken back. The scale of supervision went down. Mose was broken back to a foreman, and Carl Williams from general foreman to foreman, and Hap Frank from superintendent to general foreman. Well, Hap Frank came over and asked me if I would like to work in the office. And I said, well, I need the job, but I've never done any office work. And he'd go back and he'd talk to Carl. and I would be Carl Williams' clerk. And they said if I would take it, they wouldn't cut my pay, which would have been 11 cents an hour cut to office work. And I said, well, I can't say that because I've never touched a typewriter or done any office work. Mm-hmm. So they talked to the superintendent, and finally they persuaded me to, they'd give me an opportunity to learn if I'd take it. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know at the time they were all three Masons. There again, they were trying to take care of me without saying, come on and do it, you know. Mm-hmm. And not really take care of me, give me an opportunity to work. And so finally I said, okay, and they promised me they wouldn't cut my pay. Mm-hmm. So I went into the office, and they gave me a whole week on days to learn clerking. Mm-hmm. And I started in hunting picking. And Hap really didn't think I would make it because I was so hot-tempered and ornery. You learn in dealing with men on their equal that you had to stand up to it, and men weren't used to it. Today they're used to it. But if a woman sassed a man back or said, I won't do it, or you do it this way or that way, it was a catastrophe then. Mm-hmm. So I was known as a hothead. Hap says, well, you'll have to leave your lead hammer at the machine. And he was a dear soul. And so I went in and started clerking and dearly loved it because it was... You know, I'd go out and bring the men in that were hired and introduce them to the foreman and tell them all the rules and regulations that Northrop required and take care of their personnel records and things like that. So it was a friendly, interesting job if you love people. Mm-hmm. So I worked there, and March 28th, 1946, I hired Tom Pollard in.
Okay.
First,
because we've reached the end of the war, mm-hmm. and this is obviously going to start a whole other
chapter.
Maybe this would be a good place to...